Good afternoon, and thank you for the patience. Dan called me at noon, and I'm almost embarrassed to admit he caught me. That was my wake-up call. And he said, come straight up Avenue Road, and shared the circumstances. However, having been born and raised in Toronto, I didn't know where Avenue Road was, and I thought I would take a cab. Queen's Quay right now is so cold and so covered in snow, not plowed. There was no cabs, so I eventually drove. There's a sequence of events here, but I had a phone that broke early last week coming back from Mexico. I got some water, ocean water in it. I have a brand new phone, so I don't have driving directions. I don't know my Apple ID. I couldn't get that. So the gentleman's phone that Dan used to contact me was Mr. Blair, Robert Blair, and I called him, who he had already left, and he guided me here, and I was so grateful to have his voice in my ear and get me to be able to speak with you guys. That's pretty close, I think, Dan, what Dan shared in regards to me. I will say that I was born to Children's Aid Society, to the custody of, in 1967. I grew up in foster care homes, and by the time I turned 15 or 16, those of you who aren't familiar, most of us who, not most of us, but let's say a fair demographic of people who grew up in the child welfare system, it's not a big transition to go to the criminal justice system. And I was one of those young people. At the time, I wasn't cognizant of it, but today when I look back, I understand. And the terminology for that is a crossover kid. So you got a throwaway kid, crossover kid, you got all these different social worker terms. But when I first entered prison at 16, for the first time in my life, I found a sense of family and a sense of belonging with the people that I found there. And I often speak to the fact that I think it could be a very slippery slope for young people to tough love, or a tough approach can often work the opposite. And I know when I entered the Toronto East Detention Center at 16, by the time I left there, I had a bunch of contacts, phone numbers of people that I would have never met otherwise. And sadly, that began the road to me serving what was an aggregate sentence of 20 years, 11 months, and 13 days. Not that I counted. But that incorporated many failures. My crimes were theft orientated. Addictions played a big role in what I was doing. So those are the beginning years. And Robert Clark, I got to say, I know Robert. I've spoken with him. I'm working on creating a radio show that I'll be hosting about corrections and social issues. And Robert and I have had many conversations post-reading his book. We have very similar views, so if anybody here had read Robert's book, we have a very shared experience from... I entered into the system in 1986, albeit in a different way than Robert did, for the first time, and I was 18. And I concluded my sentence in 2010, and I'll tell you... we've had quite a transformation between now and then, and not for the better in Canada, with our correctional system. I understand tough on crime. I'm not an activist. I am an advocate. I can say that as recently as this week, I was flown into Ottawa to attend the stakeholder roundtable for Bill C-83 on solitary confinement. It was a very interesting day. I was honored to be there and to be invited by the Commissioner of the Correctional Service of Canada. But what I note is I always note such a division, and I think we're living in divisive times, period. And prisons are a microcosm of the world. So the divisiveness that we see out here is condensed and really profounded within our prison system. I was listening to a roundtable that had activists, unions, the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, which registered the challenge to begin with, Catherine Latimer, the executive director of John Howard Society, and a number of other activists that were there, and it was interesting to hear the disparity from one side to the other. All I can say is that corrections is really highly nuanced, and the cornerstones of the work I do, and yes, Dan is correct, I work with people predominantly who are first-time offenders, who are on bail, who are facing incarceration for the first time for whatever reason. I work with their families. The collateral people are always appalled, frankly, when a loved one is in and they start realizing what our correctional system is about and what's happening within it. We could do better, that's for sure. We're coming off of a 10-year period of tough on crime prior to our present government. And the culture within our prisons, and I want to make a distinction. We have two different, I'm doing my best here to capture my thoughts in light of the way the day unraveled, but provincial corrections are the jails that we have in the Toronto area and throughout Ontario. Anybody serving 2 years less a day and under are in a provincial jail, or for the most part, 70% of the people locked up in our jails in Ontario provincially are in on either immigration holds without charge, pretrial custody prior to conviction, and 30% of which are serving sentences of 2 years less a day or under. These are the jails that we're familiar with in the Toronto area, like the Toronto South Detention Center, the old Don Jail, the Toronto West, the Toronto East, Lindsay, Penetanguishene, the provincial jails. And on an average basis, there's between 8,000 and 9,000 people incarcerated in Ontario provincial jails any given day. The federal system is anything 2 years and over, and that includes lifers, murderers, but anything 2 years and above. And they're averaging Canada-wide about 14,000 to 15,000 inmates daily within the federal system. We've had a cumulative, provincially in Ontario and federally, we've had a series of events that have taken place over the course of the last 20 years that have taken Canada from the forefront of corrections, a model that worldwide people would come to see and say, hey, this is working, this is a good system, to what has often been described presently as almost third world and toxic and terrible culture and not a great investment for public safety, contrary to the rhetoric, what we were hearing for a long time. I know Robert Clark held a very pessimistic view that could change through his book. He felt that culture maybe could not be changed within the federal system. Having attended the roundtable this week, having spoken with newly appointed Commissioner Ann Kelly, to the Commissioner of the Correctional Service of Canada, and the political will that I saw from Public Safety Canada at that meeting, I believe I'm a lot more optimistic. I think we can do better, and I think we can get corrections turned around. I'm a little fearful. We're in an election year this year, so sorry. Oh, oops, I thought. You know, Robert came from a management perspective, and he was able to see what is called. And anybody who wants to reference the code or the culture, you could look at an Ontario Ombudsman report that was put out in 2013, available online. It's called The Code. And The Code is in reference to the correctional officers and the code of silence that they have in brotherhood and solidarity. And I think most people that watch movies historically, you think of crime or the mafia and stuff like that, and you think there's a code of silence there. That's pretty much fragmented and broken apart, but the code of silence really does exist among the professionals that run corrections, especially frontline, and understandably so. It's a very tough job. And in theory, it's so easy to say we can be more humane. In reality, for example, Bill C-83 about solitary. Jason Godin is the head of the Union of the Correctional Officers of Canada, and he was there to address his concerns about not having disciplinary segregation available anymore for federal corrections. I fully agree with him. I think it's a tool that has to be in place to help manage and keep people safe. And the reason I say that is there are a demographic, there is a demographic of inmates who are deeply entrenched in subculture, who are not prepared to change, who are not willing to change. And the tools, I think, for disciplinary actions have to be in place. And solitary essentially is a jail within a jail. So if you have assaulted or done something that's illegal within the confines of the prison, it's an option, a tool to be used as a punitive measure to enforce rules. I am, for an advocate side, I'm one of the few voices that say we require disciplinary segregation. Having said that, the real issue is what's called administrative segregation and indefinite terms of segregation. And that has been happening far too often within our prisons. And Ashley Smith is what triggered a lot of this. A really sad story about a young girl, I think most of you may know of it, who spent 11 months in segregation. She was in a restraining equipment for most of that. She was a frustrated, angry young teenage girl, and understandably so in light of the conditions that she was under. The coroner's inquest in Ashley Smith's case deemed the Correctional Service of Canada essentially responsible for the homicide of Ashley Smith. And that triggered a real strong review and look into solitary practices in Canada. Again, coming from the round table, I gotta say it's a highly nuanced subject. I think we need it. I think we need external oversight. I think we need more transparency within corrections. I think we're at a point where with the new commissioner and with the political will, they're looking to implement a new strategy. And what my understanding from spending that day at 111 Sussex, and it was a long day, is that the intent from the Correctional Service of Canada and its new leadership is to try to rally the troops and to do everything within their power to say what an important role they're playing in the safety of all Canadians and how important it is for public safety to have a viable, functional, productive correctional system. And we've strayed from that. We're not there right now. It's punitive in nature. It's often vindictive. There's frustration with the frontliners. I empathize with them. I don't think you could pay me enough to be a correctional officer today. There's a lot of challenges, but I also believe that if we're able to push the reset button and embrace how important this corrections can be and how people do have the power to change and to overcome adversity, but we have to provide tools and an environment where that's achievable. And presently, it's something that's a work in progress, I would say. And Robert wrote about that at length. He used a number of examples of cases where there was, one thing that comes to mind from Robert's book that I read, and again, this is short notice, and I read it quite a while ago, but he mentioned when he was early on in his career in corrections, somebody was in solitary in the hole, and there was a brand new correctional officer on, and there was a couple of veteran officers, and an inmate, they got into a tussle, and an inmate ended up banging his head. It was a push. It wasn't intended to be much. The inmate slipped. His head was cut open, and the new officer was compelled to go along with the story of the two, with his brothers, his partners. And it was an awkward spot to be in, but that young person, conflicted or not, ended up siding with his officers and said that this was an accident and that there was no role played by correctional officers. And when I think about that and I look at this, people could easily condemn it, but I understand how easy it is to fall into a position where you need to, for one, establish your workplace, for two, establish your relationships with your coworkers. And there often is an us and them mentality within our correctional system. So one of the things that I strongly impress, and I know I didn't speak too much to the legislative aspects of C-83, I certainly weighed in on, I believe we need external oversight. I believe we need more transparency. I think we need more viable options to provide treatment so that the people who are amenable and ready for change, and I can tell you most people that do enter prison are in that position. When you're a young person, I find it hard to believe that anybody aspires to be a prisoner. And I know sitting in prison, I've met with and I work with so many people who the focus is on ownership, accountability, insight, remorse, and most importantly, acceptance and forgiveness. So whatever justification they used to do what they did, whatever led them to where they were, the focus is on let's figure that out and let's make sure it never happens again. In 10 years of me running Canadian Prison Consulting, and I have a few good people on board, including Francis Kapp, who ran the group home I lived in when I was 16, who I now employ, and gratefully so. We have a 99% early conditional release rate, and we have a 100% non-recidivism rate. And the bulk of this, I would venture to say that we are tough on crime, because I turn clients away. I make it very clear in the original consult that if you're not prepared to take ownership, if you're not prepared to take a look at yourself and have insight and understand what led to where you are so that you won't be there again, I don't have time to work with you. I was able to do that, granted, through a very long stretch. I can point to all the ways to fail. I'm an expert at failing. Complacency, entitlement, the list goes on. I think I'm probably already running late. I know you guys are. One thing I'm curious about, is anybody have questions or anything that they would like me to touch upon? Give me some direction, help me. I did serve 20 years, 11 months, and 13 days, and that was over in 2010. There's a lady. Hi.
Yeah,
let's
before we do, just give me a second.
Okay.
I want to get everybody on mic.
This one is not working. Aha, there we go. So I'm going to pass this to you.
Hi.
What we're going to do, I'll take care of identifying the next
one. Okay, great. Thank you, Don. I realize I'm a little scattered. I'm still trying to figure out how to get here in part of my mind. Certainly. Yes. There we go. I was just asked to be louder.
Hi. First of all, thank you so much for coming to speak with us today. I have a question about correctional officers, actually.
Correctional officers? Yep.
Yes. So, prison reform or improving conditions for prisoners is a really unattractive option for a lot of people, especially those who don't really know anything about corrections. And I'm wondering what your opinion is on... So correctional officers have mostly, like, their training is a lot of at-home online stuff, and then tactical and defensive and in-class stuff for a few weeks.
Correct.
Following that. And I know that there's very little, there isn't a psych evaluation, there's like a screening by a nurse, and it's very...
Did you catch that story in the CBC within the last day or two? It's pretty minimal.
No.
But yeah, okay. Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'll look that up, though. I'm curious to know what your thought would be on, your thoughts on if correctional officers, if the training mandates were completely changed, if they were required to have an understanding of the social backgrounds that a lot of prisoners come from, if they were far more educated, not just in terms of tactics,
right.
But in terms of like social
yep.
issues, and if the policies and like the directives that they're supposed to follow, right. Which I'm sure you know, don't really make a lot of sense in practice a lot of the time.
Well, actually, if you read them, they're wonderful, but the implementation thereof is where it breaks down. But yeah, okay.
Okay. Well, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are if training would make, like altering training would make a big difference, or altering the reality of the policy in terms of how it's carried out would change things.
So, as straightforwardly as I can be, I just want to be clear, there's such a major distinction between Ontario Provincial Corrections, any provincial correction entity, and the Federal Correctional Service of Canada. So, the federal system right now is really working hard to hire more professionals and to do that training, and they have staff colleges and they go through months of training. Ontario Provincial Corrections, there was a story that just came out in CBC over the trial of a young man who was killed in his cell in London, Middlesex, a number of years ago. That reflects that their training is as condensed as 1 week. So that's a huge gap between provincial and federal. And federal is clearly ahead of the game on that one, as opposed to our provincial institutions. What you're going to find, you know, that's an interesting question that you put forth, is you find pushback from correctional officers often. The mandate of corrections is care, custody, and control. And correctional officers will point to the fact that their security and their mandate is the control part. They will argue they need more resources, they need more programming, they need psychiatrists, psychologists, and they're correct about that. So they're saying, we're not social workers, we're security. Having said that, it would be nice to have a little more incorporation of the social aspect into that agenda. But when, again, you're looking at a provincial correctional officer who's received 1 week of training before going on the job, which to me is mind-boggling, that's a real challenge. And yes, I think essentially the answer to the question is, I firmly believe more training is going to result in more effective corrections. And that's for everybody, because 95% of anybody locked up today will be released, and they will be our neighbors again. So the investment there is a solid one into public safety. Short-term containment is not public safety. I don't care if it's 1 year, 2 years, five, 10, people are coming back, and if, you know, again, I think we've all talked about this, we've all heard it. The investment of time and resources while they're there to try to right the ship is really important on the back end when they're coming back out. Correctional officers can play a role. What we often run into, and I've been through this provincially and federally, in addition to the private sector, I train forensic mental health. I do de-escalation training. I work with corporate government, Corrections Ontario, Public Safety Canada, trying to look at what could work. And ultimately, I see this as somehow, some way, we need to have unions, the unions of these correctional officers, have an agenda, and often they're right, but inmates end up being political footballs. And the unions for the last 10 to 20 years, both federally and provincially, have been very unhappy with the employer. And they feel like the employer has kind of missed what's happening and what they're facing day in and day out in their jobs. So when you talk about legislation, it's a point I made at Bill C-83, the roundtable, is I noted throughout my years how many times a new piece of legislation would come down. The people who work on the front lines would look at it and go, they're out to lunch. Throw it out. They have no idea what it's like to be here day in and day out. And there's some truth in that. So ultimately, my thought is, how do we rally the troops? How do we get them to embrace that this is an important aspect of public safety? How do they end up feeling, I suppose, appreciated and understood for what they're living day in and day out, because it is a really tough place to be. And yeah, it would be great if there could be a little more training mandated that would be beyond security, beyond takedowns, beyond locking people up. It would be wonderful in theory. I also think we need to just hire more program-type people and more psychologists and psychiatrists. Our forensic health facilities have been shut down. There's minimal beds. Corrections doesn't even have the option anymore. So if you get a Form 1, somebody who's mentally in a decompensated state, they're sent to a jail. The jail tries to send them to, let's say, CAMH. CAMH will take them in, and then they'll say, we don't have a bed, so they go back to the jail. There's a real hole there, and we need more professionals to be able to assist the officers, and I think train them a little bit. So, and I think that should be required, so it's a great point.
Correction officers did have more involvement with prisoners on a day-to-day basis.
More which? I'm sorry, I didn't hear it.
Sorry, if correction officers did have more interaction and more involvement with prisoners day-to-day in terms of an interaction thing and not just in terms of a security and control thing, and I understand that putting this in an existing prison would be very difficult, but imagine it from a new prison or something. If correctional officers were much more hands-on involved in the lives of prisoners. Right. If there were more of them that had, you know, a smaller group, like a living unit sort of type of thing to supervise and could be more hands-on, do you think correctional officers would be happier with their jobs? Do you think they would be more willing to engage?
I do, and I can point to our history. We don't have to look that far back. In the 80s, in the federal system, we had what was called, instead of correctional officer, they were called living unit officers. And it was working. And this is where they were right there within the common areas of where prisoners were. Relationships were established. And there was a strength that was built through the communication and dynamic. So it was effective. We've certainly strayed from that. And this has, again, been based on an ideology that I won't knock, because I think that they fully believed in it, the former federal government. I think what they put forth, they really believed would result in public safety, and hey, we can just knock it out of people. Well, I can tell you that people just dig in further when that happens, and not only that, the majority of young people involved in subculture are not paying attention to legislation that's coming out. They're just not following that. So, sadly, that was, I think, well-intentioned, but really the antithesis of what we were looking for, which was increased public safety. But I do agree, if there is the opportunity, and I think the real secret here is that, the training and the manpower to do it, but ultimately it comes down to the intake process. The very first moment a prisoner arrives, I think there should be a reception area, an intake process, an orientation, information sharing, and I think at that point the ability for corrections to filter who's who. I would say that 80% of people that come into our prisons minimally are ready to make change, are not pleased with where they are. There is probably 15 to 20% that come in and say, I don't give up. And no matter what you do, they're not going to listen. There are also people that come in decompensated states who are real challenges. If you were working day in and day out and you had feces thrown at you and you had, you know, it would be, it's not hard to understand how they become desensitized and lose their objectivity. And let's say their belief that, hey, I want to make a change every day, when they're facing some pretty egregious things. Now, granted, that's isolated. I think it's not, but in totality, you can see where these divisions really become entrenched. And I think if we were to really invest in our intake process, reception, information sharing, and filtering inmates to compatible areas, we could really make this work for everybody, for the people who work there to improve their conditions, and certainly for inmates. Okay.
In hindsight, when you left your foster home, when you were 16, can you think what our society could have done to stop you from transiting into the correctional service system?
You know, that's a good question, and my answer is probably going to be disappointing. So I'm going to clarify this. I was born to Children's Aid. I was in foster care, and I don't have any record. I've tried to find out how many foster care homes or whether it was continuity. I just haven't been able to access that. But by the time I was two, I was adopted. And then what happened was that adoption was an adoption breakdown. So that my family that adopted me by the time I was an adolescent said, "Ooh, this guy is not good. And clearly not our problem, so we're just going to do that." And I ended up back in. So that was the chain of events for me. It was a good family, don't get me wrong. It really was. Very proper, very... My adopted mother, I still have so much that I have to thank her for. My mannerisms, my politeness, because I had my mouth washed out with soap so many times, whatever I tried otherwise. But there was good things there. It didn't work. I went back into the group home system. And when I've looked at this and I've tried, when I was in my early 30s, when I hit a point where I finally realized, oh my God, I can't do this anymore. I was losing my sanity. And that was post 9/11. That was a real wake up call for me when I was locked up. But, I wanted to help and I realized that I wasn't in a position to do that. I took such a deep, hard look. I took psychology. I now have a diploma in psychology through McMaster. I now have addictions, a university diploma as well for McMaster. My only answer to that was I had people invest time in me when I was 16, but for some reason I didn't buy it. I was told, "Oh, you've got these skills, or you could do this, or you could do that," and for whatever reason, I just didn't buy it, and I don't know if there was anything that could have been done other than what happened. I had to live it, I think, to go through it in order to come out the other side and understand it, and I wish that wasn't true. I just don't know, because I did have people that were really good people that tried, and addiction is one thing that I certainly say played a role. I could say that I was insecure, I had a huge amount of anxiety, I had, and getting high was a way to run away from it all. And what goes hand in hand with that was, how do you pay for it? Well, I worked for a while, yes, but I just didn't have it together, and I don't know, I'm not sure. And that's not a great answer, because if somebody who's young today and you want to try to make that impact, and I do that work, all I can point to now is my experiences and try to encourage them not to go through what I've gone through. So I'm about the best anecdote that I can think of. But for me, I don't know. I saw that almost as an adventure. And I saw from my first time at 16 some nobility in it. And it might sound very strange, but the older guys in the jail, I had shared with me messages like, people who work for a living and who are married, they're in prison. The mortgage, the marriage, they're locked in. And I bought into that when I was 16. It was very formative. And I felt like, to a certain extent, the life I was living was much more freedom than the person who worked hard and had this day-in, day-out routine. And I don't know if anybody could have changed me to that until it came full circle. Yes, thank you for waiting for me.
Hi, my name is Linda, and I used to work for Children's Aid in an administrative capacity. But what I did do was introduce blacklight theater to the children, and for the first time in their life, they could express how they felt inside through blacklight theater, and it was a real healing time for them. Right. And I was wondering if that might be able to assist you in working with you. I also work in the courts every day, and I see people like yourself in the box of the accused, and you're bang on. I think what they need to do is triage people at the police station, not intake. They need to go and they need to say to the person who has an impaired driving charge, you don't need to be locked up with Paul Bernardo tonight.
No.
You just need to go for treatment. And they need a program for alcoholism or substance abuse. But they need a triage. They don't need incarceration.
And that's the intake you're referring to.
And
real
I have
thorough...
seen people in the box of the accused that say, Your Honor, I'm just going to plead guilty because I can't read the document.
Yep.
So they're not even being assessed if they can read, if they can write,
yep.
if they can comprehend. And what we need is a triage. And you're bang on, and congratulations.
Oh, well, thank you. I fully agree. And, you know, here's what we're up against, though, and you know this. We're living in a day and age of the oversimplifiers are winning the day. And we only have to look south of the border to see how oversimplified messages and mass emotion is just being pumped out. And I'll tell you, low-hanging fruit in Canada in the last 20 years is soft on crime, hug a thug. So this is the ongoing battle, and that message, sadly, doesn't flush out the reality of what's happening, and it does not eradicate crime. I mean, it, as a matter of fact, I believe firmly it makes it worse. But, and you're right, we need to identify these things. And there are so many people that do not require, as you say, a DUI, yes, treatment, yes, alcohol, ensure they don't drive. But our resources, and it's so expensive to lock people up, and you'd like to think that we would get a return on that investment, the billions of dollars as Canadians spend every year on our correctional and justice systems. I'm sorry? Oh, God, yeah. No, the treatment programs would be the cost part. And this is, I think, what I'm encouraging right now from our government is to emphasize the cost. Let's smart justice, better investment. Because it's a fine line. You've got, we all know historically there's two parties here. One's like, oh, tough on crime. One's, you know, they're con lovers. Well, no, I'm not on either side of that. But I do think that, hey, we need to, and that's not always been the case, but it's certainly been true in the last 20 years, and it's been detrimental. Right. When the prisoners come from the cells, yeah. Yep, Lindsay, Penetang Machine, wherever. Yeah, no, nourishment is absolutely... Yeah. They haven't eaten. No, you're right. No, they can't, because if they say, then it just gets worse for them. Well, I'm sorry, can you, your first name?
Linda.
Okay, Linda has worked with the Children's Aid Society, but she has an administrative capacity, but she works in the courts, and what she sees on a daily basis is people who are receiving are prisoners who are getting one juice box and one sandwich. Or a granola bar, pardon me, not even a sandwich. And that's the extent of the nourishment for the day of going to court and coming back to jail. And she's also noted the fact that if they are not a stronger type person and more vulnerable, that juice box and granola bar is easily taken from them. They don't have many options. If they report it, they're in more trouble. Now they're a rat, and that causes more issues for them. So the nourishment part is a big one. I mean, in the federal system, we're now on powdered milk as opposed to real milk. The farms were shut down. They were turning a profit. They were providing milk for all prisoners and making a profit. But right. So we do have a lot of issues, and we certainly can do better. I think federally the political will is there. I'm very concerned in Ontario presently with where we may be headed, and the lack of receptivity to any sort of resources going towards the Ontario provincial system. I'm fearful almost of going all the way back to the Harris government position of privatization, and I'm really hopeful, and I'm going to do everything I can within my media platform to try to dissuade Ontarians from going that way in the government. But yeah, the little things are big things, I assure you. The vested interest is required also. In the federal system, when they shut the farms, when they shut the work programs, when they shut so many of these different things under that period and became more of it, there was always a vested interest from inmate populations to, and it was incentivized, and everything in life is. And so now, no matter how prepared you are to change, or no matter how amenable you are to work towards change, it's not available, and it doesn't matter. So the persons who are going, screw you, or the person who says, I really want to change and I want help, are getting the same. There's no incentive. And without that vested interest, we're in trouble. And that makes the work conditions much harder for the employees, too, correctional officers.
You've come a long way from being, I think you said, in the correctional system for 20 years. And now you have your own psych, your own business, and you have a degree in psychology. I'm just wondering how you managed to summon up the inner resources to climb that rather uphill battle.
Well, thank you for noting that. And I think the simple question to that, and I tell this with people I work with daily, regularly, is we are more resilient than we know we are. We have more resilience than we ever believe we do. I think it's human nature often, whatever adversities we face, that we feel like, oh my God, this is insurmountable. And after the fact, you look at it and you're like, wow, you know, incredible what you're able to do. For me, I can point to a very specific period of time in my life. And I refer to 9/11. 6 months prior to 9/11, I had been returned from another failed release and picked up 7 more years consecutively that had made my sentence 20 years. I had a wife and young kids, and that was the end of my family for me, because, again, I was back in jail. I was really exhausted, tired, and feeling, it was in my early 30s, and I felt like giving up. I got back to the penitentiary, and I had come to the point where I had stature in there, and I often use the expression, part of the problem and the challenge getting out and staying out for those who've been there for a long time is exchanging a lead role in a cage for a walk-on role in the world. And that plays a role, because you feel, you know, you have stature, you're known, and then you come out and you're lucky to work at Tim Hortons, and you just feel like there's that, you know, let's say entitlement or whatever it is. But it's a tough challenge. So when I came back in after a lengthy period of time on bail, picked up more, raised my sentence to 20 years in 2000, I arrived at the penitentiary, and I had a huge welcoming committee from guys that knew me. And I was exhausted. And I just thought to myself, my God, and the reason why they welcomed me wasn't because I was a nice guy. It's, you know, I was a big man. I was always a guy who was a stabilizing influence. I believe in a despotic way, I kind of kept calm and peace and encouraged people to wear headphones and do their own time and clean up after themselves. But I also was involved in subculture, and I had the ability to have drugs come in. And I mean, these are things I had done throughout my younger life. So when I arrived, I within the first month or two, I went back to the old same old game, and I just hit a point where I had so much anxiety that I thought I would lose my mind. I felt like I was on the verge of losing my sanity, and I could not get rid of the anxiety. And I ended up working with a psychologist who was a wonderful woman. And again, I can point to the fact that in 2000, I had access to that psychologist when I put in to see her. Today, it's a much bigger challenge to do that. And I worked with her for a number of months, and I'll tell you, after about 2 or 3 months, the first person ever I've worked with who said to me, you know what, we have great chats, but we're done. And I'm like, what? Really? Why? She goes, because you're not getting real. Long story short, she pushed me, and I entered into a 6-month agreement with myself. I started university. I didn't believe I had it in me. I didn't think I had the intelligence. I had a grade 9 education at that point. So I didn't believe university was even something that I could do. And I committed to not smoking marijuana because I thought it should be legal, and I always pushed that, and not doing any form of drugs, not involved in any subculture. By the end of that six-month period, not only had I overcome what I felt was losing my sanity, I felt more empowered than I'd ever felt in my life. I had nothing to hide. I was walking in the light. And I was getting straight A's in university, and I was shocked. So for me, that was a really key period of time. And then 9/11 happened. And in the penitentiaries, we were locked down when that happened because of religious divisiveness within our prisons. And for a number of days, nobody knew what was happening. So our prisons were on lockdown. But I was an inmate committee member, so I was able to get out, speak to security, go around ranges, share information with guys as to what was going on. And all I can say is that I just, at that moment, wished that I could help and do anything, and do anything I could to... And I realized, it was a very sobering thought, to realize that I had been essentially a mini-terrorist myself through breaking into homes, through stealing, throughout my entire life. And it was a real eye-opener for me. So that period of time was a big, big catalyst. 2000, 2001. I had one further slip in 2007. But otherwise it was, and I built, yes, this inmate committee. I wrote a book, I've published it. I wasn't prepared, I don't have a copy to show you, but yeah, I put together what I felt was a very effective way of managing problems within a prison and helping people get through. So I don't know if that answered your question, but those were the key moments for me.